You're listening to Radio Times Rewind. I'm Marty Motz-Cohen. Today's episode is based on my 1994 interview with Lauren Bacall, the actress from the golden age of Hollywood who went on to become a feminist icon. Bacall had high-profile marriages to actors Humphrey Bogart and Jason Robards and frequent collaborations with director Howard Hawks. Bacall was 70 at the time, and we start with her thoughts about how the public's conception of her through her career contrasted with her own.
I think people have actually confused whatever I am in life with the characters that I've played. And, of course, the deep voice, which was one of my better features, supposedly, has worked against me in some ways because people think, oh, well, she's really tough now. She's really knows what she's doing. She's in control. And, you know, if I had one of those little voices, then people would think differently of me. But I say beware of those little voices because they're the women of steel.
Really, you're not a woman of steel?
True. Not at all. Oh, not at all. Never have been. Couldn't be. Unfortunately, I don't really know how to. I'm not ruthless. I have no killer instinct. I am not really tough at all or hard. I've just learned how to preserve myself and how to prevail,
so
which
we're talking,
is a different thing.
Yeah, and we're talking about, I guess, survival. You have good survival instincts, you think?
Oh, definitely. But I think even more, I say prevail because I remember William Faulkner, whom I knew because of the fact that he was a friend of Howard Hawks's and he worked on The Big Sleep and he was around, and I used to see him from time to time. And when he made his speech, when he accepted the Nobel Prize, it was a brilliant, brilliant speech that he made. And he gave me a copy of it, and he wrote on it that rather than survive, you are a woman who will prevail. Now, there is a fine line drawn between those two words, and I was so impressed with that that I kind of slip it in there when I can.
Well, it's an important distinction, obviously.
Yes, well, particularly because he said it to me. I mean, I feel very kind of close to it. But I think one, probably because I have spent so much of my time alone and of my life, handling my life alone and not having a lot of people around me to precede me to kind of clear the way, having to kind of do it all myself, deal with everyone myself, I think I've probably built up subconsciously a certain veneer so that I can deal with it, I guess. I mean, you know, it's not been a plan. It's not been anything that I've calculated, so.
Can I ask you about your voice? Because as I was reading about you, there was a story, and you always want to check this stuff out because you know how stories get started. I read that Howard Hawks, I guess before you were in or as he was putting you in to have or have not, took you to the mountains and had you scream across a ravine in order to lower your voice. And I must say, I thought, well, this is a novel way to approach.
Well, why wouldn't everybody do that then? No, I mean, the fact is that that's slightly exaggerated. What Howard Hawks wanted, obviously I have a low voice. I've always had a low voice. My mother had a low voice. My daughter has a low voice. So, I mean, I think we were just born with that. What he wanted, what he was concerned about, it was he said, you know, in a scene when you get excited, when you're angry, or how everyone's voice goes up one or two registers, and he said, I want yours to stay down there. No matter how anxious you get, no matter how angry you get or how excited you are, I want your voice to remain low. He had a vision, he had a plan, and he had a fantasy as well. And so he suggested that I read aloud. Now, I never went and shouted in the hills, but I did used to drive up to the hills, park, and I read The Robe aloud, sitting in the car, just, you know, to try to kind of in my subconscious keep it down there. But finally, you are what you are, you know. And the voice, if it had been just been done screaming across a ravine, then it would have disappeared.
Well, I just had this funny image of him on one side of the ravine and you on the other screaming.
Me trying to contact him. Howard!
But if he was talking about keeping your voice low as a character got excited, was he also talking about somehow containing then all the movements that go when one gets excited as well? Because certainly looking at To Have and Have Not, I mean, you move through that film, you almost float through that film with a very minimum amount of gestures. It's all very self-contained.
Well, I think part of that is because I was so terrified. And part of it is just the way I was presented. I mean, after all, he was a bit of a Svengali, Howard. I mean, he had this idea of this woman that he wanted to create. And he'd always wanted to make a star out of an unknown, and he had never been able to succeed at it until me. So it was really lucky for us both, and obviously great for me. And but in a way, I wasn't ready for it. I mean, I wasn't experienced enough or hadn't worked at my craft enough to be able to cope with it without him.
So when you look at that film, do you see a scared young girl?
Well, I see it in a lot of the play, yes. And I see also the fact that because Bogey and I fell in love after, you know, halfway through the movie, I see the fun that we had. So I see all the humor, you see, which I, of course, love. I can't live without humor, you see. No point to living. If there were no humor in the world, I think I don't know what I'd do.
Well, this is your second autobiography, I guess we could call that.
No, but this is not an autobiography.
It's not an autobiography.
No, but that must be made clear, though.
Certainly your second book. And writing, of course, requires a lot of work and then a lot of kind of caretaking as the book gets published. What does writing give you that acting doesn't?
Well, what it gives me is the ability just to express what I feel and think about a lot of subjects that obviously acting does not give me. It's very personal. And it gives me, although it's a solitary profession, the writing profession, it still gives me the feeling of kind of using my mind in a different way and calling up all of these things that some of which I'd forgotten, and feelings that I had about, for example, the friends that I write about and my children, things that I am able to write that I could not say. Writing enables you to do many things. It's a great gift, really. I mean, I'm grateful for it because it's very hard. I looked at those blank pages more than once, I can tell you, and without a thought in my head. But when it flows and when it begins to work for you and your memory begins to really work, it's wonderful.
Did you have any hesitation in writing about your children?
Well, I had hesitation in what their reaction would be. I love my children, obviously, and I mean we have our differences often from time to time, and we're all different people. Mm-hmm. But we really are close. And the only thing that I cared about, the most important thing to me, was that they liked what I wrote. And I wrote what I felt I had to write. Obviously, you don't write everything. I mean, I'm not going to write about every argument or about every, you know, unpleasantry or whatever. So I wrote, but I wrote what was important to me to write, to let them know. And then I said it to each of them when The Galleys came out, and I said, now's the time to tell me if you want me to change anything. Mm-hmm. If there's something you really don't like, you must tell me, and I will happily take it out. You know, it's no problem.
Did they ask you to change anything?
Nothing.
Nothing?
Nothing. None of them did, which I was really grateful for, you know, and I said, they really liked it. They liked the way I'd written the book, and I feel very good about that. So I think that kind of solidifies our relationships.
Well, if you're just tuning in and you think that's the voice of Lauren Bacall, you're right, it is. Lauren Bacall is our guest today on Radio Times and, of course, a well-known actress, been acting for many, many years now. I said 5 decades, and
I fainted.
You gasped.
Well, I gasped because it's so hard for me to believe.
Yeah.
I can't believe that it was me doing all of that. I can't believe I've been around this long, and yet I am still full of hope, and I have many of the same feelings and emotions that I had when I started.
And let me just quickly say that Lauren Bacall has written a new book, and it's called Now. And you might be aware that about 15 years ago, she wrote a book about herself, a memoir called By Myself. I found it interesting, and I guess we have this idea that people who reach a certain amount of celebrity and fame then don't have to deal with all the stuff that the rest of us have to do with, which is, I think, for women, how critical and harsh the world is for women as they get older. And you write about that and about being I guess, judged and evaluated based on your age and having to sort of live that down.
Well, yes, because in this country in particular, I mean, I spent a lot of time in Europe, and in this country, more than anywhere else, you are put into a slot because of the number next to your name. And you are dismissed at a certain age. I mean, after 30 in this country, you're really in trouble, you know. The minute your first line appears on your face, you have to worry, especially in my profession. I mean, we're into perfection. We're into fitness to a degree that is manic. And I just think it's all gotten out of hand. And we're not into what we are. We're not into quality, and we're not into the way we think and feel. And I think in my profession, more than any other, of course, you have to deal with all of this because so much depends upon the way you look. And it's quite depressing and terrifying because it has nothing to do with your talent, has nothing to do with the kind of person you are. It is a fight, and it is something that I really am not happy with. And I think most women in my profession feel the same way because it has nothing to do with really being older, my age. It has to do with women. Look at all the actresses in their 40s who cannot find a decent part. Mm-hmm. And who worry about the way they look and who have to have endless surgery and endless things. I mean, it's all in the quest for approval and for work. And it's a terrible reason to have to do all that, you know.
Do you worry about the way you look? Did you go through periods where you worried about it?
Well, I've never liked it, and I always worry about it.
You've
but I know
this. You never liked the way you looked?
No. I've never been. No, I just never have been. True. I mean, it's not. I'm not making that up. But it doesn't matter. But I just have never. I look in the mirror. I go, oh God, so depressing. And that's why that's why these terrible photographs appear, mm-hmm. you know, in newspapers because I make faces all the time because I can't stand the way I look. I look the best that I can look in order to work. You know.
Well, can you tell, even in the kind of parts that are given to you, or perhaps even the parts that are not given to you, that you know the higher-ups have made this decision about Lauren Bacall and what she can and can't do, and perhaps even limiting, having a very limited view about what you can and can't do?
Oh, totally, totally limited. But also the higher-ups change every 20 seconds, you know, in L.A. And so you don't know, and they don't think about me at all, a lot of them. So, I mean, you have to fight for that. For recognition, for remember, hello. And they say, oh, way back.
Is that because of people out there now 24 years old?
Well, that
things?
And also because they're not movie lovers. They're into money, like this country is into money. It's everything is about money, and it's really upsetting.
So are there some parts that you've seen other people get that you would have just loved to have?
Well, I mean, there's no particular role that I can think of offhand, but I know that there are parts that I could have played that I have not played. And I know it's because of the narrow thinking of the people involved in the making of the movie. I mean, why, for example, at 60 should you suddenly not have a relationship with a man? Why should there not be an adult relationship that people can understand? 70 and 80, why not? What is wrong with that? Why isn't it the most natural thing in the world? But you know, in movies now, boy, mm-hmm. you got to be 25, and with a 60-year-old guy is fine. But
we'll pick up on that. But you know, we have a lot of people who want to talk with you. And again, our guest on Radio Times today is Lauren Bacall, and she's just written her second book, and it's called Now, and it's published by Knopf. Let's go to Beth, who's been hanging on from Fort Washington.
Hi.
Hi, Beth.
How are you?
I'm fine.
I'm one of your great fans.
Well,
50 years ago in Washington, I was a really gawky teenager, and my best friend and I had enormous crushes on Lauren Bacall. She sought to have her have not 17 times, and I think I saw it 3. Anyway, we sneaked ourselves into the National Press Club balcony that memorable day. Do you remember?
I sure do.
And we watched you sitting on the piano with Harry Truman. He was almost president, but not quite. I think it was just before Roosevelt died.
It was,
and we were soaring. We were ecstatic. worshiping, and we grabbed a taxi and followed you out to National Airport. I can remember you had a tan beige gabardine suit and gold earrings and brown high-heeled shoes, and we were so timid, but we went up to you, and we said, oh, could we have your autograph? And you said, sure. And we almost died on the spot. Well, anyway, I wanted you to remember that wonderful day. And also, I heard you on Charlie Rose the other night, and I really like your politics. And I'm also a woman alone, so I share that with you.
Oh, that's great. Thank you.
So I will enjoy your book enormously.
Thank you, Beth.
Thank you.
Thanks
Bye.
A lot. And, of course, that famous photograph of you on top of the piano.
I know it. But it's so wonderful because I've never known anyone that was actually there. I've not spoken to anyone who was actually there at the time. And it all was an accident. From my point of view, I mean, I was there with the vice president of Warner Brothers, who'd been traveling with me on my first publicity tour, and he was head of publicity at Warner's, and when Truman came out and sat at the piano, he said to me, "Go on, get up there and sit on the piano." And so I said, "Sit on the piano?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Okay," you know, I did as I was told, and I got up there and I sat on the piano, and they took a picture.
And
that was it. And I had an exchange of, hello, how are you? And Truman looked up and smiled, and I smiled. And that was the end of it.
You know, I looked at that photograph, and I was thinking, you know, I wonder whether that would happen today without some kind of scandalous report the next day in the paper.
Well, not only scandalous, but Secret Service probably would have, you know,
right,
ripped me off, would have knocked me off the piano.
Let me ask you about a theme that actually that Beth raised, but certainly is part of... part of your book about being alone. And I guess, I mean, certainly for everybody, this it's being pulled between wanting some solitary time and certainly wanting to be with people and to feel some kind of affiliation. And you write about that a lot. I mean, do you find yourself then caught between these two conflicting conditions and then, I guess, two conflicting emotions?
Absolutely, yes. I find that it's, I enjoy an awful lot of, there are many aspects of being alone that I really do enjoy. And there are many perks to it, but there are those moments, you know, when you really feel the need of wanting to share something, usually a good time, not a bad time, and wanting to have a companion, someone mm-hmm. that you really enjoy being with. It's very hard to find someone that you enjoy being with, that you want to talk to. For me, it's almost impossible, and I don't quite know why, but that's the luck of the draw, you know. But I really feel that I would rather be alone than be with somebody that I couldn't talk to.
And is that something that's come with age, you think, where you realize that time is precious and short and I just want to spend it the way I want to spend it?
No. I mean, I think I was alone when I was very young. And... I mean, I don't think age really has a lot to do with it. Mm-hmm. I just think that unless, of course, if I fall down in my apartment and there's nobody there to help me up, I'll be in trouble, but I don't want to think about that. But other than that, I just, no, it's not age. It's just the fact that I suppose there have been periods in my life where I have closed myself off to anyone entering my sphere and have focused on work, or focused on my children or other things. And so I never found a personal relationship that had any sense of permanence to it. And maybe I didn't want it. I don't know. But I never stopped to analyze it because I can't be bothered to analyze everything. It's too dreary. But I just kept on living, you know. And so I'm still doing that. I just noticed and have noticed, which is the reason that I write about it, over the last 15 years, I've become more and more aware of the couple society in which we live. And everyone is a couple, and it's shall the four of us do this or the four of us do that, go to dinner, go to a movie, whatever. Let's the four of us meet next Tuesday and blah, blah. And it's never, why don't the three of us meet, you know? But I have a couple of friends that really call me up because they want to be with me. Mm-hmm. A couple of couple friends, which I really value a lot because it means much more to me than I think they realize, that when a pair of people call you up because they really want to see you and be with you, it's pretty terrific.
You call that the couple syndrome. And
yes.
It's this idea that everything has to go in even
in pairs.
Numbers.
Oh, I know it. It's like a dinner table. The people that still have dinner tables say, we must have boy, girl, boy, girl, boy, girl. Please.
Lauren Bacall is our guest today on Radio Times, and of course, well known to people who go to the movies or love good theater. And she's also written two books. Her latest one is called Now. Well, you said you don't want to analyze things too much, but there was a quote I ran across, and I just wanted to try it out on you. And you said, being married for the first time to a grown man has made it hard to be with other men. Of course, you're talking about Humphrey Bogart.
Yes.
You mean that?
Well, yes, because he was a grown-up. He was he knew what he was about. He believed in very definitely in the way to live, in what was right and what was wrong. There were no doubts in his mind. Well, that's rare. I mean, that's almost impossible to find. I find that too many men are boys.
Hmm. Even 50-year-old men, 60-year-old men.
I think especially. especially. I think actually younger men are much easier for me to make contact with than older men, because I find the older men are so busy preening and trying to hold themselves together and trying to be worshipped by younger girls and be told how wonderful they are and be unable to sustain a relationship, that they're just impossible to communicate with, which is unfortunate. It's sad. I mean, obviously there are exceptions, but there are not many exceptions.
Hmm. You also write that you carry around the kind of core of Bogart in you, and you describe him as a teacher. There was, of course, a great many years between the two of you.
Yes. Yes. Well, no, he did teach me a tremendous amount. He taught me a lot about the business, about the profession, about the esteem in which actors are held or not held, and the importance of keeping your eye on the road that you travel. And not being pulled over to the side by other people.
That's that core you're talking about.
Yes, which he never was, you see. And I, without him, probably would easily have gone from side to side to side. Because a lot of those side trips are very attractive. But they interfere with the center of your life. And they disrupt it and they can wreck it. And he knew that. And, of course, I didn't. So somehow, you know, also I've carried on what I mean when I write in the book about Bogey kind of being in the center somehow of what I am. It's because, unbeknownst to me, he has permeated my life, because it's like carrying on in his tradition. I tell the truth to people whether they want to hear it or not, which does not endear me to everyone, I can tell you. And I kind of have responded to things the way he does, the way he did. And it's very strange. I just find it kind of funny, too, in a way, that I'm kind of the female Bogart I'm carrying on. But I at least continuing the thread of what he believed in. And so that, to my amazement and amusement, I mean, that has happened to me.
But he seemed to carry the thread of what your mother believed in. And certainly, as you have talked and written about both of them, they seem to have some very core ideas in common.
Oh, they did. And they were contemporaries. So it was, you know, she really started me on the road to, on the importance of character and the importance of truth and honesty and honor and integrity. And he, of course, continued it. And so now it just kind of unwittingly happened to me that I'm continuing it, and I've lectured my children. They're so sick of hearing me talk about it. But, you know, over the years, that's what I've done, because I really think it's the most valuable thing that you can teach your children.
Did they like each other, your mother and Humphrey Bogart?
They adored each other, finally. At the beginning, no, my mother did not trust him for a second.
No.
Why wouldn't he be in love with a beautiful young girl? Three marriages. Why wouldn't he? She didn't trust him at all. And then he, of course, was very defensive with her. And then, of course, the minute we were together, she changed, and he changed. They really adored one another.
That was actress Lauren Bacall talking with me live in studio in 1994. In just a moment, we'll be back with more Radio Times Rewind, including her thoughts about plastic surgery and a caller who shoots his shot and asks Bacall for a date. Welcome back to Radio Times Rewind. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Let's get back to my 1994 interview with Lauren Bacall. We'll restart the conversation with a question from a caller about Bacall's training as an actor.
And we have Connie on the line from Chalfont. Hi, oh. Connie.
Hi. I was wondering whether Lauren Bacall had any formal acting training as a young person, or whether it's a natural talent that she has, and also whether any of her children are in show business or grandchildren.
Yes, I did have training. I went to dramatic school when I was in high school, a school called New York School of the Theater. I went every Saturday and began to learn the rudiments of stage acting. And then I went to the American Academy for a year in New York, which also had to do with the theater. I never thought in terms of movies, you see, so I certainly didn't have any movie training. And then I was in two shows before I went to Hollywood, one of which I called myself an outstanding walk-on because I had no dialogue, and another because which I had a speaking part but never opened in New York. Mm. So I did have training.
That your natural talent itself, do you think anyone's natural talent is essential for success in the acting business? Or do you think that people can be trained to do those roles?
Well, I think you can be trained in technique. I think you have to learn technique in order to be in the theater, certainly. But I think that natural talent is essential if you want to last. I think you can be fly-by-night big hit for 20 minutes, you know, if you just have a knack, kind of. But I think if you really have ability, I think that's what keeps you going for many, many years.
And you think that's something that the acting coaches and trainers can pick up pretty quickly?
I don't think you can be taught that, you see. I think you either have that or you don't have it. That's what makes you, I think, a star, and what makes you someone that prevails, that continues to work.
Well, one of the things you say in your book is that the essential of acting is about honesty and about truth, and I don't think you can't really fake that too well. I mean, it's clear when someone hasn't reached that.
Yes, if you tell the truth in your character, and when you're dealing you're playing a scene with another actor, that's essential.
What about your children?
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, well, my children, my young son, Sam Robards, is an actor and a wonderful actor who has unfortunately not had a break yet, but he will have it because he's really got it. And I'm not saying that just because I love him, but I'm saying it because he's got it. The grandchildren are too small to even think along such lines.
Did you ever want to steer your children away from acting, thinking that would be too tough, too public, too lonely, too whatever? Or did you think, why not?
Well, I told them the pitfalls, because it is a life of rejection. And obviously my Bogart children had other problems. They had to rise above the icon of a father that they had but didn't know.
They were pretty young when he died.
Yes, well, Leslie was 4 and a half and Steve was 8. He had just turned 8. And Steve has gone into television production. He deals with the news a lot. And he's loved that. And he was on Court TV for a couple of years. And in actual fact, he's writing a book now about his growing up without his father. Which I think will be very interesting.
Well, you've also said that it was very hard for him to say who his father was, that was a real struggle for him.
Well, of course it was, because, you know, can you imagine with everyone saying, are you really Humphrey Bogart's son? Well, tell me, what was he like? So he couldn't find out anything about himself. So he did. He had a very tough time in school. He loved it. He loved the school, but, I mean, he had a tough time emotionally, I think.
Connie, thanks for calling in. Thanks a lot. What for you is the difference between being on stage and being in front of a camera?
Well, the big difference is that the stage is live.
Right.
And that's exciting. And you have a real exchange with the audience. And that what happens at each performance will never happen again. And that's thrilling. And that you get immediate response from an audience. You really connect with people. You don't get that on screen. On screen, it's a different thing. It's a wonderful medium, and you have contact with the people you're working with at the time, and then it's over. You have a better life because you have more freedom, and you travel a great deal with making movies, which is one of the great things that motion pictures offers you. But the finished product is seen 6 months later, or maybe longer. So that you know, you then when you look at it, you say, oh, I remember that, and I remember what I was doing. But 9 chances to 10, you're working on something else at the time. So it's not that immediate thing for an actor. You see, movies are in the, really the final result depends on the director and how he cuts the film.
And can you feel it when you go out on stage, whatever that is, when everything is right?
Oh, boy.
I mean, is there a word to describe what that is?
Well, it's just the... No, it is indescribable, actually, because, I mean, I had it in Cactus Flower, and I had it in Applause more than I've ever had it. And that incredible connection is just... It makes you feel as though you are floating. I mean, you just... You are extraterrestrial. You are not of this world. It's really an amazing feeling when the audience really responds to you and you really, they get what you're doing and you do it better because of that. It's just, oh, it's worth everything.
Well, we have still a lot of people want to talk to you. Let's talk to Steve calling us from Philadelphia.
Hi, Mrs. Bacall, it's a pleasure to speak with you. And I think you have one of the most phenomenal voices around. And I've heard a rumor that at one time you were doing a song and it was Andy Williams who dubbed for you in the song. Is that true?
Well, I think what is true is that Howard Hawks thought that there were certain notes in the song, How Little We Know, that I might have a problem hitting, as I was not a singer and am not a singer. And Andy Williams was someone he knew, and he called him in to record. Mm. But the fact is that it was not used.
It was not used.
No, it was not used. It was my. If you listen, if you ever see it and listen, you can damn well tell it's my voice because Andy Williams has a great voice, and of course I don't and didn't.
Yes, you do.
but well, singing, I'm speaking of.
Right. But it is a pleasure to be able to speak with you.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Thanks, Steve. Let's go over to Bucks County, and we have Brenda on the line. Hi, Brenda. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you very much. This is quite an honor to talk to Lauren Bacall. I'm just so thrilled. Lauren, every time, I think you're an inspiration to all women, and every time I'm tempted to tiptoe to the pity pot, I ask myself, what would Bacall do? And I run away from the pity pot because of that, and I think you should know that you're an inspiration to a lot of women for a lot of reasons. And in that, would you ever consider doing series TV?
Well, I have been asked on several occasions to be in a series, and I have always rejected the idea because I find that it's very hard to keep the standard up. And I've never been presented with an idea that I was that fascinated with. I prefer more variety in my life, and I prefer to go between stage and motion pictures. But I like television, and I would love to be in a miniseries, but they haven't offered me anything yet.
Hard to believe.
That is very difficult to believe because you have so many varied facets of your personality and so many gifts to the women out there in the audience and the young men who are strong enough to accept your honesty.
Well, apparently the young men are doing better than some of the older men.
Absolutely.
And there are very, very, very many fans. And so in that, I have an idea for you that I think you would be perfect in. Of course, like very many women, I have a grand idea. And
well, go for it, Brenda.
How would one contact you?
Well, you could probably contact her through Knopf.
Yes,
up in New York.
That's
probably the best thing. KNOPF. It's the name of her publisher.
Okay.
And they can take it from
this
there.
This has been wonderful, and you have certainly made my day.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Perhaps I'll just code my letter with you're helping me to avoid the pity pot.
Okay. Thank you, Brenda. Thanks a lot. What is that like to think that you're a role model for as Brenda says, for many women and for young men, too? What does that mean?
Well, I'm not quite sure. I mean, I'm very flattered because I think it is meant as a compliment, certainly, but I'm not sure I understand it. I don't really think in those terms. I don't analyze my life very much. Mm-hmm. I don't think of what effect I'm having on people. I just kind of mush my way through
So you don't think, oh, goodness, maybe I shouldn't do that for fear that
something is... No, not at all. Unfortunately, I should censor myself a little bit more. I think
We appreciate the honesty.
Yeah, but sometimes I think I do overdo it. I have overdone it in the past, but listen.
Yeah. So you don't... I mean, you've had to live with fame. You've had to live with celebrity, but you don't want to think about it, or you don't think about it.
No, I don't. I mean, the only time I think about it is if I'm going out to a public event, and then obviously then you become really aware of it. But other than that, I don't know why. I've never dwelt on it. I've never, I don't look at my scrapbooks. I don't think, gee, I'm going to go out on the street now and knock them dead. I just don't think along those lines. I just think I'm really a worker, and I really think more in those terms than I do in any other.
And we put some clips and things together. I know that you don't necessarily want to have a nostalgic time today, but actually we did want to play a clip. And this is from How to Marry a Millionaire. And why don't I just play the clip, and then we can just talk about it after. And this is with Marilyn Monroe and Betty Grable.
Oh, but that's the point about this whole setup. Of course I want to get married again. Who doesn't? It's the biggest thing you can do in life. The way most people go about it, they use more brains picking a horse in the third at Belmont than they do picking a husband.
Do they really?
It's your head you've got to use, not your heart.
Oh, I see. Tell her your idea about this apartment.
Well, to put it simply, the idea is this. If you had your choice of everybody in the world, which would you rather marry? A rich guy or a poor one?
I think I'd rather marry a rich one.
All right, then, where would you be more likely to meet a rich one? In a walk up on Amsterdam Avenue or in a joint like this?
Well, I should say in a joint like this.
Okay, then that's it. We're all working steady, so we throw everything we make into the kitty and get a little organization into this marriage caper. Class address, class background, class characters. To be specific about it, nothing under 6 figures a year.
I've never heard anything so intelligent in my life.
Well, if you want to catch a mouse, you set a mouse trap. So, all right, we set a bear trap. Now, all we've got to do is one of us has got to knock off a bear.
You mean marry him?
Well, if you don't marry him, you haven't caught him. He's caught you.
That's great.
It's so funny, that movie. I love that.
Is that one of your favorite movies?
Yes, it is. And you know, it was based on a play called The Greeks Have a Word for It by Zoe Akins. Oh.
Well, you know, I must say, looking at To Have and Have Not last night, it was amazing the amount of smoking that went on, first of all, in that movie, but also how expressive it was, depending on who was lighting whose cigarette and who was blowing out.
It's very dramatic, and it's very romantic, and it's sexy, unfortunately.
I mean, that's what it is, smoking. That cigarette, I mean, was so much more impressive and so much more effective than words. I mean, you're just leaning over as you're lighting the cigarette and looking up. I mean, it's a killer.
Yeah, and blowing out the match.
Yes.
Just so.
But unfortunately, it kills you, son. It did Bogey.
Yeah.
But,
well, let's get back to the phones here. We have Marvin on the line from Philadelphia.
Morning.
Hi, Marvin.
I'm 60, I won't say.
Oh, you can say.
I have a wonderful sense of humor, and I'm available for lunch. This is a dating service, isn't it?
You opened yourself up, didn't you?
No, it's not a dating service.
Oh, it's not a dating service. Oh, darn it.
We're just having a casual conversation here, Marvin.
I think Lauren Bacall should be doing a one-woman show on stage, and I think she'd be ideal for it.
Has that ever come your way?
No, really. What would I do? I mean, what would it be about?
Whatever. I you know, I didn't.
Well, you can't
you
get out of stage
hour,
and
I'll
just
do,
whatever.
I'll put it together for you. I mean, all the people, get Sondheim or somebody to do a few songs for you.
And, oh, really? He's got nothing else to do.
I don't.
Love it because I sing so beautifully.
Well, you
he likes Sopranos.
You did star in several musicals.
Yes, true. Well, I can do it in the context of a show, of a play, of a plot, you know, but it's something quite different to stand up there and.
Well, you could do
singer.
The story of your life in song. You could pick out songs from different periods.
I have to tell you, Marvin, her face just blanched at your suggestion. Thanks for your call.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot. Let's go over to Levittown. We have Jane on the line.
Good morning.
Hi, Jane.
Or good afternoon,
whichever it is, but go ahead, Jane.
Lauren, it really is a pleasure to talk with you, and I mimic the other women who have spoken about what a model you are. And one of the things that you said in your first book was that you didn't ever want to have plastic surgery. You thought it was dishonest and all that kind of thing. And I recently saw you on, I don't know, something that you were on, and you look absolutely incredible. And I have to ask, have you stuck to your resolve?
Oh, that's a loaded question. Go ahead, Lauren McCall.
Well, that's a loaded question that I have no intention of going into detail about, certainly. But, well, I think I've had a little help along the way, but not a lot.
Well, I'm very grateful for you saying that, because mm-hmm. I have a son who is determined that I should not do that. As he put it, Mother, we don't do that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, he's right, actually. I mean, it's the competitive world of my profession, unfortunately, and it's very tough. It's a tough call to just to give yourself more of a work life, you know.
I understand but the practicalities of it for you, but it's also created such a difficulty for just everyday average women like myself.
Well, I think it's a nightmare. I mean,
terrible.
I certainly don't recommend it. I don't think it's anything that anyone should rush into. Certainly, I don't rush into it, and I think you do whatever you have to do depending upon what your life is. But
well, I agree with that totally.
I think an awful lot of women in my profession have just become ridiculous. They're unrecognizable. I don't know what they've done to themselves.
And
but
I agree with
it too
that
often.
As well.
Well, it's almost like a toupee. I mean, you can almost see when someone has gone too far.
Oh, yes.
It's clearly written
when they don't move,
yes.
Nothing moves.
Jane, thanks for your call.
Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Let's go over to Westchester. We have Jean on the line.
Applause for a very honest woman.
Thank you.
And I'm also very grateful to hear someone who is also having difficulty as far as work is concerned and the youth factor. I face that all the time myself. It has nothing to do with talent. Mm-hmm. However, my question is, it is no secret that the two men that you were married to did have some problems with alcohol. And I wondered how you were able to cope with that, because in spite of all the good times, there must have been times when there was pain.
Well, number one, Bogey did not have an alcohol problem. He was a heavy drinker. And when I first met him, he drank too much because he'd been in the habit of doing that through his last marriage before me. But he was not an alcoholic. It did not consume him. He was in control of it. Jason did have problems with it and has admitted to that. Those problems, and it was very difficult for him, and it's difficult, and I think it's very hard to live with that.
Well, I'm sure that it was, and so when you see all the accolades that you have received also, in spite of that, I'm sure that there were times when life was difficult.
Well, of course. I mean, how can you live and not have difficult times?
And I think
life is not a bowl of cherries.
No, and sometimes I feel that when we put people in that category of celebrity, that all people see is what the good things are mm-hmm. and not what some of the difficulties can be.
Well, I think that's true. And I also think that people have a misconception about my profession in thinking that it's so glamorous and glorious all the time. They don't realize how much hard work goes into it and how much training and how much rejection is involved.
Rejection is a very, very difficult emotion to deal with for anyone.
Sure
yes.
is. Well, Jean, I thank you for calling in.
Thank you so much for your honesty and for all the good times in the movies.
No, thank you so much.
Bye now.
Bye-bye. Do you have a favorite movie? Or a favorite part that you played in a movie?
Well, I have several. Well, Designing Woman I adored. I had great fun playing that part. I had fun with Orient Express. I've had fun with a lot of movies, in actual fact. I've been very fortunate. And then there were a couple I didn't have so much fun with.
Oh, like what?
They were quite terrible, like Confidential Agent and Shock Treatment. Horrible movies, both disastrously bad.
Did you know that while you were making them? Did you realize that?
I knew it about Shock Treatment. I did not know it about a Confidential Agent because, again, I was 19 years old. And Jack Warner, that was the only time I allowed him to choose for me. And he did, and it almost ruined me.
Mm. So you were marked early on in your career then?
Oh, definitely. I was just as great as I was after To Have and Have Not. That's how terrible they said I was, all those critics. And they said, get rid of her. I mean, they were brutal to me. Yeah. So that I spent the next 20 years in front of everyone trying to climb back up there.
20 years, you think?
Well, you never get quite back up there, you know, in the same way. Certainly you don't.
Well, let's see what Brian from Wilmington has to say.
Hmm.
Hi, Brian. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning. Thank you for allowing me to get through. I was just driving down the highway on the way to my office, and I heard Miss Bacall on the radio. And I thought, my gosh, if I ever get a chance to speak to her in person, I've got to just sound her praises.
Well, you're doing it.
I'm 43. I'm obviously male. And Miss Bacall, you are absolutely an inspiration to us. And I heard several callers calling, and you were sort of wondering why you were such a role model. And I thought, I've got to call you and tell you why.
Yeah, why, right?
Basically, because Miss Bacall has such poise and such manners. She has such a good command of the English language. She is an absolute lady. I watched her on TV the other night, and she was being interviewed, and I thought, my God, this generation has such a lack of the things that Miss Bacall has. They seem to be so natural. I'm sure that she has grown and grown into this, but my God, what an inspiration. I go places, and I see an appalling lack of manners on the part of today's society, and I see this lady. I've watched her in commercials. I think you did a couple of commercials, if I'm not mistaken. And everything I've seen you do, I have just stood back and said, my God, this is such an inspiration to see somebody like this. And you're very charming. You are. The other thing that I find that is most fascinating is that most of the world lives in facades. They're constantly having to put on a front because of their fear of what people will see behind the facade. And Miss Bacall is just out there, and we all love that. It's very refreshing. It's very encouraging. She's very bold, and she inspires a lot of people to just take off the masks and be a little freer.
Well, Brian, I almost hated to interrupt you there.
Yes.
And just listening to what
you see what I say
to...
about younger men?
Well, I heard that, too. And, you know, I thought, my God, you know, I could see why, because you don't threaten people by your honesty, I don't think. I find it very refreshing. As I listen to you talk everywhere you go, I said, my God, I think... If I didn't sound like a groupie, I'd race to Philadelphia just to get your autograph and to take a picture of you in person. Because your integrity and your honesty, your forthrightness, everything. I just wouldn't want to sound like I was smothering you, but my God, you really.
I think you are, Brian. But
no, but I love it. Thank you very much.
Hold on one second. but what you've also written about is that. Your honesty and your toughness, that you've also paid a price for that. I mean, not everyone is as accepting as Brian is of
right,
of who you are.
Right, but it's not toughness. It is not tough. I am not tough. It is strength. Hmm. I mean, it's that you have to, I've had to be strong to last, to get through a lot of the rotten times.
That was my 1994 interview with actress Lauren Bacall. Joining me now in studio is WHYY executive producer Kevin McCory, who's helping me sort through the archives to make this new Radio Times Rewind series. Hey, Kevin.
Hey, Marty. Glad to be back.
So Lauren Bacall, what did you make of her?
I have to admit, right, like I'm sure I've seen some of those old movies with her and Humphrey Bogart, but she wasn't somebody who was really on my radar as a person who was born in 1983. Mm. But I was struck by just her poise and her, I don't know, her forcefulness of her personality, and then also just how the callers responded to her. Like, they adored her. That was so cool.
Yeah, a lot of the women callers were, you know, you're giving me permission to be myself. I mean, that was a lovely connection. And if my memory serves me well, and again, this is 1994, so 31 years ago, she was quite moved by the callers. I do remember that. I have to say, I was probably a little nervous. Mm. I mean, this is Lauren Bacall. I'm older than you, Kevin. So she was someone that I saw in the movies, and she was sexy and beautiful, married to Humphrey Bogart, to Jason Robards. I mean, she was this Hollywood icon, and she didn't know me. So I wasn't sure, like, would we be able to talk? Was she nice? Was she going to be difficult? All those kind of questions. And she was lovely. I mean, I think, as you can tell, she was very honest, very forthcoming, very self-deprecating in a way. She knew herself. I think she was about 70 years old, so she knew herself. And I thoroughly enjoyed talking to her. I felt like I can throw anything at her. She'll be fine. Yeah. We'll be fine together.
And I guess, what was your experience with her films as you were growing up? Like, what do you remember about her?
Oh, well, her voice, which we talk about quite a bit, but she had this very husky, sexy voice. She was gorgeous. And she had this way of moving across the screen. I never saw her on stage, but across the screen in this very sort of floaty, self-possessed way. She's one of those actors, which is why she's a star, where you just look at her. You see her on screen and you're just drawn to her. She had great charisma and I think great presence.
What was really fascinating was her talking about the public's perception of her versus her own perception of herself.
Yeah.
I guess that's common, right? Like the way that we think about ourselves and the way others see us can be so different.
Indeed. And she talked about how everyone thought she was this tough broad, you know, could kind of boss people around. And she would say, no, I'm a softie. You know, I'm a pushover. Although I have a feeling she's probably pretty tough. I mean, you know, I don't think you get to be Lauren Bacall if you're just a total pushover.
Yeah. And then I guess at some point as her career went on, she kind of found a way to establish a second act, and she was a real force on Broadway and in the theater, and you know, was used in movies more in a supporting role, even in the 90s and the 2000s. And you really got the sense that she was someone who, I guess, figured out the business of Hollywood and somehow, as she said, managed to survive and keep thriving.
Yeah, and kind of reinventing herself, I think, as it went along. She also talks about how Hollywood is so cruel when it comes to a woman over 30 is considered old, but she obviously defied that. You know, there was something that she did, and I just remembered it, actually, when the show was over. And we always give credits, you know, to the producers and to the engineers and the people that helped to make a show that we have here at HYY possible. She was floored. She said, wait a minute, you give out credits to the people behind the scenes like every single day? And I said, well, of course we do. But she was quite surprised and I think very happy about that.
Yeah, that's
a
interesting.
Little moment.
That's interesting.
And it's also just, I mean, to have some, it's wonderful to talk to someone remotely and you can put them on the screen and all that kind of stuff. Nothing beats having someone in the studio, you know, where you literally can make eye contact, or you can see what they're doing with their hands, or you just get so much information. And so with Lauren Bacall, I felt like, oh, okay. The moment I met her, I felt, oh, this is going to work.
Right.
This is going to work.
I got to admit, honestly, right, jealous, not of the specific interview, but the idea that like a big star like that would come in studio. These days, it'll be like, even if they say yes, we'll do it on Zoom.
Exactly.
Right? And exactly. You lose so much in translation.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of these archive interviews that we're going to be playing, these were people in studio because in the olden days, people went on book tours, or if they had a movie, they would tour the country and go to public radio stations or go to the library and give a talk. And those days seem to be really disappearing pretty fast. It's too bad. Radio Times Rewind is a WHYY special series on Sunday evenings. Kevin McCrory and I are the executive producers of the show. Our engineer is Diana Martinez. Next Sunday, my 1997 interview with comedian George Carlin.